Thank you for inviting me to speak. I'm going to do something a little bit unusual at the Strings Conference and actually talk about string theory with like worksheets, and which maybe is not as fashionable as it used to be. So the last time I spoke at Strings, I didn't talk about string theory. I reviewed recent progress in horizon thermodynamics. But on my last slide, I mentioned this old idea of Suske and Uglum, where they argued that you could get the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in string theory from strings that cross the event horizon of a black hole. But it turns out that their calculation of A over 4G requires the use of off-shell string theory. Now, at the time I wrote that slide, to me, off-shell string theory meant scary stuff I don't understand. But thanks to my postdoc, Emma, and a lot of discussions, that's no longer true. And my goal is to demystify the subject and explain how it was used by Suske and Uglum. So in their 1994 calculation of black hole entropy, well, they said they were calculating black hole entropy, but they took the infinite mass limit, which means they were really calculating the Rydler entropy in Minkowski spacetime. They discussed 10-dimensional superstring theory, but the D equals 26 bosonic theory is similar in all of the relevant aspects, so we could discuss that instead. And the basic idea is that they calculate the entropy by introducing a conical singularity by replacing the 2 pi angle around the horizon with a beta that's not necessarily equal to 2 pi, and then you apply the standard variation of the free energy formula, S equals 1 minus beta d by beta of the partition function of, well, this would normally be the log of the partition function of the target space theory, but that's the same as the partition function of the worksheet, because you can have any number of disconnected worksheets, so you have to exponentiate. So they plugged in the sphere worksheet amplitude, and they got exactly A over 4G. However, it turns out this has to be the off-shell sphere worksheet amplitude, because you've introduced this conical singularity, which means that the Einstein equation is no longer satisfied to the bulk, which means there's a non-zero beta function, which means the worksheet is not a CFT. So this means they're inherently doing off-shell string theory. And even though this paper is widely cited for various other reasons, as far as we can tell, the vast majority of the string community did not actually understand this argument, and partly because the substantive string theory content was all implicitly under the hood. There was one citation they made to the work of Zetwin, and all of the important equations for the paper were actually arose from derivations that were just incorporated by reference to this work of Zetwin. So if you just read the paper the first 5 times you read it, it seems like they just sort of pulled out the answer by magic and you don't know where it came from. So I'm going to try to explain where it came from. So basically, this is... So I think the laughter indicates I don't actually need to explain this slide. It's, so a lot of the work is being done down here. So to motivate why off-shell string theory is a thing we should think about, suppose we consider the leading order classical closed Euclidean signature bosonic string theory action, which is given by this formula up to a total derivative. So we have an integral over target space. D would be 26 here. Of capital G is the target space metric. Phi is the dilaton. And then we have some second derivatives of the massless fields. And then there's some order alpha prime corrections. So in the usual formalism of string theory that you would get from, say, reading Polchinski's textbook, you would derive this indirectly. First, you'd calculate the condition for the beta functions to vanish, and that would give you the equations of motion. And then you'd just say, oh, well, this is an action up to a total derivative, which you can't work out by this method. This is the action that would give you these equations of motion. Now, note this is exactly the opposite of how we like to analyze theories in field theory. In field theory, we want to start with the action because it's the most fundamental equation and derive everything else from that. Here, we just sort of go, magically, it came from an action and we aren't sure why. Well, you have to do off-shell string theory to explain why. And the reason, suppose we tried to get this action directly from the world sheet. So the first thing to notice is this factor of e to the minus 2 phi out front here. This is basically equivalent to 1 over the string coupling squared. So that's telling you that this classical action is coming from sphere diagrams. So that makes sense, because sphere diagrams are related to tree-level processes, which are classical. And we would normally evaluate this for a CFT with central charge zero in string theory. But in that case, if we evaluated this action for some fields that we've already turned on, and we view the fields that we've already turned on as just specifying which CFT we're discussing, then relative to that particular CFT, to calculate the action, we wouldn't want any additional insertions. And so we would actually be evaluating the sphere diagram with zero insertions. And by the standard, somewhat hand-wavy argument, if we have zero insertions on the sphere, we're dividing by the SL2C conformal Killing group, which has infinite volume, so we get zero. Now, in a sense, this is the correct answer, because this action also has the property that up to a total derivative term, it vanishes on shell. The reason it vanishes on shell is because of the way the dilaton comes out in front of the action like this. If you vary the dilaton, you get something proportional to the action itself. And as long as the dilaton only enters the stuff in brackets with derivatives, up to a total derivative, the dilaton equation of motion sets this to zero. So in a sense, that's consistent. But zero equals zero is not an interesting calculation. It's not enough to get this equation to pop out. So we're going to have to do something more subtle. One way to motivate this is to ask the question of why there's a tree-level S matrix in the first place. We all know that the sphere diagram may vanish, but the tree-level S matrix does not vanish. This is easy enough to see in the usual formalism. We've modified the sphere by adding a bunch of vertex operators corresponding to these external lines. But suppose we sort of take into account the meaning of these vertex operators as a deformation of the field theory, then each of these vertex operators would just be a plane wave of some kind, something like e to the I p dot x, where the positive or negative frequency will give us creation or annihilation operators, so that that'll determine whether the particles are coming in or out. And then we could just evaluate the effective action in this new background, we're consisting of a bunch of plane waves, extract the S matrix elements by asking what's multilinear in various of these coherent states coming in. And relative to this new perturbed background, we go back to the story with zero insertions. So how do we get a non-zero answer? Well, there has to be a resolution. And in fact, there's two resolutions. And fortunately, these two resolutions are actually consistent with each other. So the first thing you can say is that the new background is actually off-shell. And that's why the action doesn't vanish. Because when we add a bunch of plane waves to the diagram, the plane waves don't have a linear beta function, but because of the interactions, there could be a nonlinear beta function. And if we take n minus 1 of these insertions, here n would be 4, then those n minus 1 plane waves when multiplied together, will give us an order amplitude to the n minus 1 beta function in the nth plane wave, and that non-zero beta function is related to the fact that this thing is non-zero. But then, where even the S matrix, which we are used to thinking of as on-shell, is actually an off-shell object. There's another way to think about it, which is we could say, okay, when we added all these plane waves, we're not on shell anymore, but we could push the background a little bit and push it back on shell by making a tiny adjustment to the fields, whatever it needs to be to cancel this beta function, which you can normally do in a non-compact space, and that'll push us back on shell. But if we push ourselves back on shell, there's going to be some long tails of this adjustment, and they fall off sufficiently slowly in the IR that you actually now have to worry about the boundary terms in the on-shell action out at infinity. So because a first-order perturbation to a solution doesn't actually change the effective action to first order, if you believe that these boundary terms exist and that you've satisfied the Euler-Lagrange equations with you include these boundary terms, it must necessarily be that these two approaches, the off-shell approach and the boundary term approach, actually agree with each other. And we don't actually need to know what these boundary terms are to say that make this argument. We just have to believe that they exist. Why there's long tails? Well, recall that the dimension of an operator is given by delta minus 2 is the condition for marginality. That's proportional to p squared plus m squared. So if we're on shell, that corresponds to a marginal coupling. If we have a nonlinear beta function of these plane waves, we can adjust the oscillators by canceling it with a linear beta function. But because the linear beta function is proportional to delta minus 2, we'll have a 1 over delta minus 2, and that has a pole at delta equals 2. It's that pole in momentum space that gives us an inverse Laplacian in position space that says there's something going on in the IR. This is actually very similar to the Gibbons-Hawking calculations of the black hole entropy. Here again, we have two different ways to calculate the entropy. We can either use the off-shell method, where we introduce a conical singularity, or there's an on-shell method, where we just change the boundary condition at infinity and find the smooth interior. And there again, since these differ just by a first-order perturbation to the solution, which is number two here, the actual amplitude is the same for both sides, and we get the same entropy. All right, so it follows, to derive the classical string action properly, we're going to need to understand at least one of the following from a world sheet perspective. We either need to understand boundary terms, or we need to go off-shell. From this perspective, one way to think about the usefulness of going off-shell is we won't have to figure out what's going on with the boundary terms. Now, in the rest of this talk, I want to explain how to take string theory off-shell using Zetland's formalism. And the most important papers for us here are these, but there's at least twice as many that I didn't cite here, and various people who worked on related stuff. So we tried to condense everything down to two papers, and to also justify the prescription with some new arguments for its validity, and to extend it using the language of conformal perturbation theory. So the basic setup is this. Because we're going off-shell, we write down a world sheet QFT instead of a world sheet CFT. So we're using conformal perturbation theory around a CFT. So our perturbation will be a sum over operators that we can insert. And one class of operators is primary operators, and their coefficient will be some propagating target space mode. And so I is like a sum over target space modes, almost like a Zamolnikov index. And there's also dilettantic modes that have a power of the Ricci scalar in them. And this is going to correspond to this field phi twiddle. It's actually not quite the same as the usual dilettante because there's actually a piece of the metric that has a Weyl anomaly that makes it transform in a non-primary way. So it actually includes some of the metric too. And then the primary term that we would normally associate with the propagating dilettante is actually a different linear combination of these things, which is primary. This is all in Polchinski. And we aren't going to allow more complicated things like descendants because these all have weight at least 4, and that's actually going to turn out to be outside the regime of validity anyway. Epsilon is the UV cutoff of the theory, and the only reason we've included it explicitly in this action here is for technical convenience, to ensure that epsilon is the only dimensional constant that appears anywhere in this Lagrangian. If we did not do that, we'd have to differentiate later with respect to various other dimensional constants. So every time you see epsilon, it's really encoding everything dimensional. But it's also the UV cutoff of this theory, which could be, for example, a proper distance cutoff, which would regulate two operator insertions from coming arbitrarily close to each other in proper distance, and that would prevent there from being divergences. Now, unlike non-critical string theory, we are not going to integrate over the vial mode square root of g as a dynamical field in the world sheet path integral. That's the wrong thing to do when going off shell, because it would make add an extra degree of freedom, which would mean when we go back on cell to a CFT, that would be a discontinuous limit, which we don't want. Instead, we're going to do something that looks bad, which is we'll just arbitrarily pick square root of g. But it turns out it's OK. The reason why it's OK is that varying square root of g is just a beta function. It's renormalization. And the beta functions can be fully absorbed into target space field redefinitions. So if you pick one vial frame and I pick a different vial frame, we actually have the same theory. It's just related by target space field redefinitions. That's why that's OK. You still have to gauge fix the 2D diffeomorphism symmetry, and you end up with the same BC ghost sector that you do in the usual on-shell covariant formalism. This UV cutoff is needed because now we have a QFT and not a CFT, and its role, as pointed out by Susskind, in the absence of a world sheet UV cutoff, the world sheet of a string actually fluctuates so violently that a single string fills all of space-time. So you need a cutoff to talk about a string being localized. And a UV cutoff will prevent vertex operators on the sphere from coming arbitrarily close as they approach each other. That's like conformally related to a long tube opening up. So it's like strings propagating from place to place. So in target space, epsilon is like a cutoff that prevents strings from propagating large distances. And physically, if you have a bunch of strings coming in from a distance in a coherent state, you could take them into account by just adjusting the value of the local fields where you are. That's morally what renormalization is. And then we have a dial that we can turn. So because these different values of epsilon are physically equivalent, we can make it be whatever you want. So if we make it order unity on a unit sphere, we're going to end up with a target space action that's approximately local at distances above the string length. On the other hand, if we take it to zero, then things can propagate arbitrarily far, and you get the Euclidean S matrix. So if you're confused about how in this formalism you get both a local action and an S matrix, well, this is how. You can turn this up. There's another weirder thing you could do, which is to take log epsilon to I infinity. This is actually what you'd want to do to get a Lorentzian S matrix. And to damp out some oscillations, you actually need a damping factor that's a different kind of epsilon that gives you an I epsilon prescription. So we actually showed in our paper how to get the I epsilon prescription of the Lorentzian S matrix as well. OK, so you might think everything's great, especially since CFTs, a compact CFT has the property that the one-point function insertions vanish by conformal invariance. At least the primaries do. So that's good, because it seems to imply we'll automatically find that the sphere action is stationary if we expand around a CFT. Now, in a non-compact case, you can have a non-zero n equals 1 function because of non-normalizable modes, which is actually what's happening in the Susskind-Uglum setup, where there's just one derivative of beta. But let's think about the compact case on this slide. There's still a problem. The problem is there's a special class of terms that can have a one-point function. It's terms that don't depend on x. It just depends on some power of Ricci. So there's a cosmological constant, which is like the zero mode of the bosonic tachyon. There's an Einstein-Hilbert term, which is like the zero mode of the dilaton. And there can be higher powers of R. There are things that don't appear in the string spectrum at all, and we don't know how to deal with. Okay? So we're going to have a regime of validity that avoids these, but we're actively working on trying to extend this formalism. So to eliminate the unwanted tadpoles, Tatlin does a strange thing. So instead of fixing 3 points, which is not a thing that's defined off-shell, he's going to do something that's morally equivalent to fixing 3 points, but is still defined off-shell. And that thing is to differentiate with respect to the log of the UV cutoff. So this is what is we call the T1 prescription. And its regime of validity is when delta is sufficiently close to marginality, so you don't get by RG flow a cosmological constant R squared term. There is, however, a second prescription that, in the interest of time, maybe I won't say in detail, but it is possible to deal with the bosonic tachyon by a slightly more complicated prescription. So it's the R squared that we really don't know how to deal with yet. Okay, when we look at the 2-point amplitude, or when we apply these prescriptions, we find that there's a 2 minus delta C function-like behavior, which is plus or minus for relevant and irrelevant degrees of freedom. And this is actually the leading order part of a perturbative C theorem to all orders. So that's good. It means the action sign is going to depend on whether it's relevant or irrelevant. When you look at the dilatonic coupling, the R shifts the power by 2, and you end up with different behavior. And the important thing about this is in the regime where we trust this, it has the opposite sign relative to the primary case, which at first looks very weird, but it's actually necessary to recover the conformal mode problem of GR. I say problem, but it's just a fact that in Euclidean signature, the modes of square root G have the opposite sign. If we'd gotten the same sign, we wouldn't have been able to recover the gravitational action, so this approach would just have failed. Okay, so it's good that it has the opposite sign. And we also have 3-point amplitudes. There's an argument why it's sufficient to check that you get the right equation of motion, to check that everything works for marginal primaries. So in our paper, we have an argument that this prescription is actually going to be correct to all orders in G string and to all orders in alpha prime, because we have actually a finite size window at a given end of this delta minus 2. So that's actually better than the all orders in alpha prime. Now, the argument you get the right S matrix involves thinking about the different SL2C frames. And the idea here is that if you forbid the vertex operators from getting too close, you can do a boost. And the boost, you can't do too large of a boost, because if you do, it'll be regulated by this UV cutoff. So we're interested in the volume of a certain regulated three-dimensional hyperbolic space. And that volume is regulated by the UV cutoff. And the only universal part of this expression is the part in front of the log. So if you tried to just divide by the volume, this would be a very complicated thing, and these different coefficients would be horrible and depend on conformal cross ratios and lots of other things. But if instead you differentiate with respect to the log and throw out the powers, you're just extracting this coefficient, so it's exactly the same as quotienting out. Now, what we end up doing is looking at the sphere partition function, and there's actually a two-loop calculation. This is following Tsetlin very closely. So you look at two-loop calculations, and from this, you extract this physics. The integral over target space is like the zero mode of the sphere, which could be centered in various places. And then we path integrate the Feynman diagrams over the non-zero modes. And interestingly, it's actually the fact that these edges are missing the zero mode that's what gives you this Einstein-Hilbert term that is where ultimately when we differentiate by log epsilon to get R, that's where this Susskind-Ugglin black hole entropy is going to come from. All right, there's also an open string picture in their paper where they wanted to talk about strings beginning and ending on the horizon. So this picture, we still don't know how to make sense of beyond the level of cartoons. There's lots of problems with it. Like there's a 1 over G string extra factor per string endpoint, which actually doesn't look statistical because we still don't have a statistical explanation of the world sheet Einstein-Hilbert term. So string theories induce gravity in the sense the target space comes entirely from the world. The target space action comes entirely from the world sheet, but the world sheet has a Einstein-Hilbert term that we don't know how to statistically interpret. And these strings fluctuate so much they actually cross the horizon infinitely many times, and we don't know what the boundary conditions are. So it's this part is very confusing. This is not the part we made sense of. I don't have time to discuss this, but we compared this picture to the orbifold method, and we concluded that the orbifold method is fundamentally different because it doesn't allow strings to pigeon off at the tip. So that actually explains why that did not give what looked like a unitary thing. Maybe the story is different if you allow twisted tachyons to condense, but that would be a much more difficult calculation. All right. We had a possible way to motivate an ER equals EPR construction from this, but in the interest of time, I think I'd rather have questions. So we'll just go here.
It's time for questions. Okay, Don. I guess it's coming fast.
Coming. Oh.
All right. So you had a brief reference to the conformal mode vector problem.
Yeah.
And I was just curious, is the implication that if I tried to use this formalism for off-shell string theory, and if I maybe, well, is there something that's required as like a contour rotation to do off-shell string theory, like people say there is in off-shell Euclidean gravity?
No, because our analysis is we're just starting with strings propagating on a fixed background that's just an off-shell background. So we aren't doing this metric path integral. Maybe you wouldn't, so maybe you could try to argue the propagating strings are somehow equivalent to such a thing, but that would go beyond anything we did.
Other questions? Okay, let me ask.
Yeah.
Does this give you any insight into non-perturbative effects?
We actually don't know how to justify it non-perturbatively, which is actually a little strange because it's very closely related to the C theorem. And on the plane, the C theorem is possible to prove non-perturbatively in the couplings. So I've been trying to get a version of this that works non-perturbatively in the number of insertions, and it turns out to be actually very difficult for some problematic reasons that is associated with the fact that you're on the sphere instead of the plane. So this is related to the work I'm doing with Alex and Anna, but the thing we can say about the sphere is that it works the Euler's and perturbation theory.
Daniel?
Thanks. Yeah, so I'd just like to understand the motivation a little better. So we can, of course, just use the low energy effective action, including all the alpha prime corrections that we got from scattering amplitudes, and we can do the usual Gibbons-Hawking prescription. So in the optimistic scenario, is this just going to reproduce that, but you know, from a worldsheet starting point, or is it going to teach us something that we can't get by doing that?
I mean, the hope is that we learn something we can't get from doing that from the worldsheet. Now, admittedly, by doing it, by first deriving the action and then doing the count, we sort of guaranteed that it's going to match on. But the hope maybe, and maybe this hope would be fully justified if we made sense of the open string pictures, that it's going to give us some more insight into the into what the statistical degrees of freedom are. But it probably means that going on to calculate all this stuff with higher curvature is probably not going to tell us something particularly new compared to the field theory story.
Thanks.
Okay, we have a question on the Zoom.
Yes, okay. Hi, thank you very much for the nice talk. I was wondering, you were showing the ER equals EPR slide only shortly, and I was wondering whether you could comment on such a realization.
Right, so this is very hand-wavy, but part of the goal was to try to come up with a situation where a hole in the geometry would be equivalent to which the entanglement would be equivalent to a connected geometry. So the idea is we would start with this off-shell Euclidean wormhole orbifold, this thing, and the whole point of this is just to find some construction where we've cut out a disk in our space-time. So then this thing is a manifestly statistical background where everything is local in this beta direction. But then, if you believe Damokar's type of idea, you say, well, maybe the twisted strings condense some tachyon condensation, and then there's some RG flow from there. If your RG flow ends up giving you back ordinary Minkowski spacetime, then you've just explained this geometric connection entirely in terms of what, in this picture, looks like entanglement of some string degrees of freedom. That was the idea. Okay.
Thank you.
Last question.
Hi. So in order to go off shell, right, you do not integrate over and gauge fix the vial degree of freedom, right?
Correct.
That's one of the pieces that connects the Polyakov construction to the original Nambu-Goto story. So it would seem that the interpretation of this in terms of strings propagating and interacting is sort of less clear because of this?
So I don't know how to re-express this in terms of the original Nambu-Goto formalism. I've thought about it a bit. There's some very confusing aspects. One thing you could try to do is say, if I could pick the vowel frame to be anything, maybe I could pick it to be something like the square root of the determinant of derivative x or something, and try to move things back. I think actually, if you start with just Minkowski space, you do end up back with the Nambu-Goto. But if you consider all possible perturbations, it's complicated, weird. But one point to make is the SL2C zero mode problem that appears in Polyakov is already there in Nambu-Goto. It's already there just from diffeomorphisms. The diffeomorphisms can be non-compact. So I think, when you think about fluctuating Nambu-Goto strings, it's not a way to avoid this sort of infinite volume. I think it just becomes an infinite volume killing symmetry.
I was just talking about physical interpretation more than the technical problem.
That's the best I could do right now.
Great. So we unfortunately have to move on. So let's thank Aaron again.